Welcome everyone, and we're back, and I'm wearing my t-shirt, okay, camera. Zoom in on this t-shirt. That's a very important statement I want you all to read before we begin. There it goes. What does it say? Can you read it? Not lip deep, heart deep. Don't forget that. And who said that? Who knows who said that? It's not lip deep, it's heart deep. Does anyone know who said that? All of you out there in the studio audience all over the world? I'll give you a hint who said that. He was Srila Prabhupada's spiritual master. Now who could that be? Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said the holy name comes from the heart. It doesn't just come from the lips. So anything real comes from the heart. That's the point. You know, we talk about lip service. Anybody can say anything. And then we talk about walk the talk. So, but with chanting, the lips move after the heart is praying. That's what it means. Anyway, we're talking about offending devotees now, but I'm wearing the t-shirt. I thought you may want to know or wonder why I'm wearing it or what it means. So that's what it means. Now, welcome everyone. Last week we had a wonderful interactive discussion. You may remember that I asked you why we criticize. What are the reasons? And you all came up with so many wonderful reasons. Not least among them was that we like to do it, which is sort of unfortunate for a Vaishnava to like to criticize. But it's true. We wouldn't do it if we didn't like it. And a funny thing happened on the way to the show. Actually, a few nights ago, one of my godbrothers told me he had attended a lecture by Radhanaswami. And Radhanaswami was, he said, was going on for hours and hours talking about how much we enjoy criticizing, how much happiness we get from criticizing, how much pleasure we get from criticizing. What's wrong with us? We get pleasure from putting others down. It sounds like Duryodhana. You know, Duryodhana, he didn't think anyone was better than him. That means it was impossible for him to say good things about other people. And so he enjoyed putting other people down. And part of that enjoyment sometimes is just this intense need to do it, like we, in a sense, function for that, or we live for that. Or that's, it's our nature is such that we cannot stop doing it. So that's a problem. Obviously, it's a problem. And it's a problem that any of you out there who have this problem should admit that you like to do it. And you should also admit it's not a very good thing to like. It's actually quite perverted. I was thinking Sishupal. Sishupal did not like Krishna at all. And every time Krishna was being glorified in the presence of Sishupal, he was just burning up mad. He couldn't take it. Drove him crazy. So sometimes when we criticize another, or particularly someone that we're critical of, if they're being honored or respected, what to speak of glorified, it really bothers us. So why do we enjoy criticizing? What does it do? I had a friend, he became a devotee, and he said he used to be a hunter. And I grew up in Los Angeles, so hunters were like aliens to us. We never met one, we never saw one. We just thought they existed in movies or something, or, you know, they were on another planet. But now I moved out here to Alachua, and so many hunters in Alachua. And in fact, one devotee who was raised out here in Florida told me he was a hunter. I said, what's the big thing with hunting? He said, you get a big rush when you kill an animal. So I think criticism is, I mean, it's not like killing, but I think criticism is similar. You know, you get this rush. What's the rush? You get to go up, and you get to push another person down. If that's somebody's idea of pleasure, that's a problem. And at least it's a problem materially, it's a problem spiritually. So what are we going to do about it? We get pleasure from putting people down because it makes us feel good to put people down because that pushes us up. And it makes us feel really good if we can look down upon people. That's a problem. The higher I go, the more I'm respected, the more people appreciate me, honor me, glorify me, better I feel. That's a problem. And if I have to put people down in order to be honored, then I do it. And it makes me feel good, makes me feel better about myself. That's perverted. If you need to feel good about yourself by putting people down, that's a problem. So when we're dealing with this problem, in a sense, it's a complex issue because we come to the material world to imitate Krishna. And so it feels good. So anything we do that helps us, enables us, allows us to imitate Krishna makes us feel good in a perverted way. So that's what we're dealing with. Now, I also told a story, I believe it was last time or the time before, I told a story about a devotee during Kartik who was staying in Vrindavan who made a vow. Does anybody remember the vow he made? Anyone out there in Krishna.com land remember this vow, this devotee? He said, I'm going to make a vow during Kartik, and he told this vow to a friend, and the friend didn't think it was a big thing. Until the friend tried doing it. And then he found out for himself how difficult it was. Who remembers what that vow was? Anyone? I'll give you a hint. It has something to do with what we're talking about. He made a vow not to do what? Could anybody guess? He made a vow not to blank any devotee. He made a vow not to criticize, yes. So, thank you, Mitra. Now, the devotee, he told a godbrother, this is my vow, and the godbrother thought, not to criticize. So the godbrother thought, that's not really much of a vow. You know, during Kartik, you should take something more difficult, like some devotee. Let's say you're really attached to eating. So during Kartik, you'll take a vow: I will only eat one meal a day. Or you may take a vow: I'll only eat one meal a day, and it'll just be khichdi, and there'll be no salt or spice, and I won't eat any sweets. Or like khichdi's the only thing I'll eat. You know, that would be an austerity, wouldn't it? For a whole month, eat once a day khichdi without spice, salt, and pepper. No sweets, no chapati, nothing. You know, so that, you know, so this devotee who heard that his god brother took a vow not to criticize thought it's not really a big vow because he was doing something more difficult, like eating once a day, chanting 64 rounds, etc., rising very early. He was doing things of that nature that were difficult for the average devotee and difficult even for him, although he's very advanced. So this devotee said, I'm taking a vow not to criticize anyone. And the devotee thought, well, that's not really, it's not like really a vow. It's not like a big thing. But the other devotee thought about it. He said, maybe I'll take that vow. And then by taking that vow, he realized, what did he realize? Who knows what he realized when he took that vow? Could you imagine, could you guess what his realization was after taking that? Anyone out there? What do you think? He took the vow, and do you think he thought, oh man, this is like not even a vow. This is like ridiculous. This is not a vow. This is easy. Or do you think he thought, this is really difficult? Yeah, Kremlin got, yeah. He took it thinking it was easy, and then once he took it, he realized, at that point, he realized how critical he was. Because criticism doesn't only mean what you speak, it also means what you think. So I'm sure you've had the experience, when you try to stop doing something, then you realize how much you do it. Right? Right now, I would like all of you out there to stop thinking of a blue broom. Don't think of a blue broom. I will not allow you. Tell your mind not to think of a blue broom. Just don't think of it. Okay? No blue brooms. Right? So, how many of you were thinking of blue brooms? Yeah, you all raised your hand. So, when you try not to do something, you realize it's not as easy. And you realize, you may realize, and I think what he realizes when you stop doing something, you realize how much you do it. Right? Yes or yes? Right. Thank you. You realize how difficult it is. Or, thanks for agreeing with me, Manjesh. You realize how difficult it is. And so that's the devotee. He didn't realize how critical he was in general. Oh, yeah, Kremlin was still on the blue brooms. He wasn't paying attention anymore. So you realize how much you're doing something when you try not to do it, when you try to stop doing it. So, okay, now, the aim of this class is that we would like everyone who hears this class and hears the other classes I have given to come to a point where they stop criticizing devotees and non-devotees, or at least they catch themselves when they begin and then they stop. Or if they do it, they apologize to those who they criticized and they serve them. That's part of the process. You apologize, ask for forgiveness, and render service. So that gradually the tendency to criticize will be subdued. And on the other side, we want to increase the tendency to appreciate, the tendency to see the good in others, the tendency to honor others, respect others. So both of these things are difficult. For many of us, it doesn't come naturally. It's like a real stretch. What do you mean, not criticize? That's all I do. That's like who I am. If I don't criticize, I have no identity. I'm a no man. I'm a nomad. That's who I am. So some of us are like that. It's like our persona, our raison d'etre, just to criticize. It's unfortunate when we want to become Krishna conscious. So now you may say, well, that's all and good. Easy for you to say. That's the goal. That's the aim. That's what we're striving for. But how do you do it? Okay. There's a couple ways to do it. Now, some of you out there, I suspect, are very determined people. And if you set your mind to do something, you will do it. And so for those of you out there who have that kind of determination, it's going to be a little easier. Because if you want to do something, you can just fix your mind. You can make a vow. You can say, I'm going to do this. And you're strong. You can hold tight to it. So for people like that, then it's very good to come to the point of saying, this is what I want to do. I want to stop criticizing. Now, those of you who are not like that, who tend to make vows and not keep them, or are kind of lazy or not that determined, due to that, the kind of person you are, you're going to have to try a lot harder. In either case, you know, and people who are less determined tend to give up more easily. I would say, if that's your nature, you should just try harder. You know, have you ever heard that? Sometimes they interview athletes and successful athletes. And they say, how did you become successful? And they'd say, well, I wasn't that good an athlete, so, you know, the normal athletes would practice till about 6, and then they'd go home. But I would practice till 10 at night, because I wasn't as good as them. So while they were at home doing something else, I was still practicing. So in the same vein, those of us who tend to be a little more scattered, less focused, less fixed, less able to carry out what we'd like to carry out, we have to try even harder. But there's a stage that both personality types need to come to, and this is the stage. If we don't come to, we really can't do anything. We can't make any change, but nothing happens. We have to come to the point in which we feel on a deep level that avoiding criticism and honoring and respecting and praising others is something we really want to do, that it makes us feel good. Just like we're saying, why we feel so good when we criticize, we get so much juice out of putting people down. Or what did Kremlin say? He said, we get a false sense of self-worth. Yeah, it was like we make believe we're something we're not. We make believe we're better than other people if we put them down. So, you know, it's a kind of perverted pleasure. So, if we change that, if we could feel the same kind of pleasure from respecting somebody, by seeing their good qualities, by rendering service, glorifying them, appreciating them, the exact opposite of criticism, if we could actually feel great pleasure, then it would not be that difficult to avoid criticism. So that is a key. Natural question is, how do I do that? Is that a good question to ask? How do I do that? Well, before we answer that question, let's look at Krishna consciousness in general. How do you do anything in Krishna consciousness if you don't feel like doing it? Well, at one level, you kick yourself in the rear end and you bang your head against the wall and you just do it, even if you don't want to. But you can't go on forever that way. And many of us started out with a bang. And we were full of vim and vigor for Krishna consciousness, full of enthusiasm. But many of us were like balloons with little holes in them, and gradually the air was leaking out. So what does Prabhupada say? He said, well, actually, the real secret, if you want to continue with determination, is you have to have some taste, because that's what drives you. So the real key in this situation is how can we get a taste for glorifying and honoring other devotees? And how can we get a taste for avoiding criticism? Because if we have the taste, then it's not going to be difficult to avoid criticism, because we'll want to honor them. Right? Make sense? Does that make sense, Manjesh? Yes or yes? Everyone raise your hand. Say that makes sense. Okay. So, now, how do you cultivate that kind of taste? Thanks for asking that question. Very good question. I'm glad you asked it. How do you cultivate that taste? We're here on a delay, so I ask a question, and then about, isn't it like 5 or 10 seconds after I ask it, you finally hear it, and then you type it in, so everything's like, okay, Kremlin's raising everybody's Vishvani. Vishvani Devi Vayuvani Vidvan from the Isopanishad. Vishva, universes. So, okay, now let's look at the process of Krishna consciousness in general. We know from studying the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, and we also know from practicing Krishna consciousness, that we do many things which in the beginning, we don't like doing, we don't have a taste for, but we do them because they are principles we need to practice in order to become advanced in Krishna consciousness. And some of these practices we do are the things that pure devotees do, but they don't practice doing it, they just do it. And we learn from experience and also from scripture that by doing these things regularly, daily if possible, we begin to become attracted to them because they are spiritual activities, and spiritual activities are attractive to us as spiritual beings. So it is infinitely more attractive and pleasing to the soul to honor someone than it is to criticize them. And if you've ever honored someone, like I think I was telling you recently, There was a devotee here who left her body, very nice devotee, and often what happens when someone leaves their body, you find out a lot more about them than you ever knew. And so many devotees are honoring them with words of glorification, kind words, words of appreciation. They tell about the sacrifices the devotee has made, the kindness of the devotee, the compassion, and so forth. So we're hearing a devotee being glorified. We're getting the opportunity to glorify the devotee, and it's very, very pleasing. Even the devotee's left their body and we're lamenting. At the same time, we're deriving immense pleasure from hearing about the glories of that devotee. Unless, of course, we're envious of that devotee. Then we go crazy hearing that. And we go, that's not true. They're not like that. You're just saying that. But you have to be pretty envious to feel that way when someone has left their body. But it does happen sometimes. But in general, devotees derive great pleasure by hearing the glories of another devotee or by getting the opportunity to speak in glorification of that devotee. Now, if we attended an assembly, if a devotee died and we attended assembly, everybody started criticizing that devotee. How do you think everyone would feel? How do you think we'd feel? So-and-so just died. Let's just criticize them. There's my chance. That dirty, nasty rascal, you can't believe all the horrible things they did to me. Let me tell you, they did this, they did that. And so how would we feel, and how would that be of any benefit to anyone? But we feel very purified in the assembly of devotees who are glorifying another devotee. So when we get experiences like that, it gives us a realization that, yes, this is near and dear to the soul. This is a spiritual activity, to appreciate, to honor, to respect, especially those who I may not naturally want to honor or respect, but we gradually get a taste. And particularly we see by doing that how it affects our consciousness and how it helps us in Krishna consciousness. It has such a positive effect doing that. And then if you compare that to criticism, it has such a negative effect. So if we practice not offending, and if we practice honoring, seeing the good in others, whatever good there is, seeing it, speaking about it, appreciating it, letting them know that you appreciate it, it's so much different. And your experience of dealing with that person and your general experience of Krishna consciousness is different. And then you will gradually begin to get a taste for that. And then from a taste, it'll start to become a habit. It is very critical here. Because we're either going to have a habit to criticize or we're going to have a habit to honor. So if you have a choice, which one would you rather have? Obviously, we'd rather have the habit to criticize. No, only kidding. We'd rather have the habit to honor. Well, maybe some of us would rather have the habit to criticize. It seems like we would, because most of us still have it. So the best way to overcome a bad habit is to develop a new habit. So I'm saying, okay, I was advising you should stop criticizing, and you might be thinking, oh, that's so difficult, I'm so critical. All right. Well, the best way to stop criticizing is to speak nicely about someone. And would you like to hear something wonderful that I'll tell you, that I read once upon a time? When you speak about other people, you should speak in such a way as if they were in earshot of you, in which they could hear you. You never want to speak in such a way that if that ever got back to that person, that would not be good for you, for that relationship. So if you keep that in mind, whatever you speak about someone, speak in a way as if they were hearing that, or speak in a way as if they heard that, if that what you said was recorded and given to them, it would not be disturbing to them. It would be actually pleasing. They would be pleased that you said that. Well, or if not pleased, at least they would consider what you said is true and honest. Could you repeat that? The very last thing I said was, okay, I'll go back a little. I was saying habits, good habits replace bad habits. And so instead of just stopping criticism, we want to replace the habit of speaking. Speaking in a favorable way, honoring people, speaking in a way that honors, that respects. Ideally, that would glorify them. And then the next thing was speak in such a way that if that person heard you, they would be happy, not disturbed. You know, sometimes we feel the freedom to speak negatively about someone if they are not listening to us. But think that I should not say anything about anybody that they would be upset with if they heard. And as you know, sometimes they do hear what you say. So, now, if we practice, as we practice anything in Krishna consciousness, such as hearing, such as chanting, such as serving, such as deity worship, if we practice these things regularly, we get a taste. And then it becomes, when you have a taste, it becomes natural to do it more, and then it starts to change your nature, your behavior, so it becomes a new habit. Now you've got this habit. Wouldn't it be nice to have a habit? Your habit is to say nice things about other devotees. Okay, that would be a nice habit. Now, we also discuss, sometimes a situation comes up where somebody is doing things which are not nice and we need to speak about them. And we did discuss that. And the conclusion we came to was that if you must speak in a critical way, it's not because you personally want to criticize, enjoy criticizing, you are envious, jealous, or whatever, or it makes you feel good, or you want to put them down. But there's some benefit. There's a reason to do it that will be beneficial to somebody. Either to stop that person from doing something because they're hurting others, or to stop that person from doing something because they're hurting themselves. There'll be some benefit. So that's a different thing. And that's okay if that's your position. So, my experience in devotional service is that, and also outside of devotional service, that if we come to a realization of why something is good, and the realization is very clear, and the realization is very strong, at that point, there is a very good opportunity that we begin to develop a taste to change behavior. And I'll give you an example. I may have given this example before, but I want to give it again. It's a nice example because it happened to me in my life, and it was a profound realization for me of how easy it is to change, but there needs to be an impetus. So I was in charge of a temple in a country, and it was very, very difficult for me in this situation for a number of reasons. And the devotees in the temple, English was not their first language. It was a different culture. It was a different country. There was such a big difference between me and them that it made communication difficult. Aside from that, we were raised differently, so we had different standards. We looked at things differently. I expected a certain standard, but their standards were lower than what I expected, so I would make assumptions when I asked them to do things. It would be done to a certain standard, but they had lower standards, which I thought were insufficient or were too low. And so you could imagine in dealing with the devotees, my expectations were always left unmet because they never did things the way I wanted them to do. And even when I explained it, sometimes they couldn't understand why they needed to do it that way, or they maybe couldn't even understand, sometimes they couldn't even understand how to do it that way. The whole thing was foreign to them. It didn't make sense. So I'd ask them to do something, and then it would get done, and it was like, and then I'd say, why did you do it like this? What's wrong with you? Don't you know how to do this? And then they would just stare at me. It was like they didn't know what I meant. And that would continually happen. And then some devotees from the West, this was in Africa, and then some devotees from the West would come, and they'd see how things were going on in the temple, and they'd come to me and they'd say, why? There's the big why. Why devotees do are they doing this? And why are they doing that? And why do they do it this way? And why don't they do it that way? And you know what my answer was? Don't ask why, because there's no answer. You'll just get frustrated. So I'm living in this situation. And there are other frustrating, you know, situations. The country's poor. You know, it's just, you know, it's just, why don't you do it like this? No, in our country we do it this way. Yeah, I know, but that doesn't make any sense. That's an inferior. No, we just do it this way. It works, you know, so it works for them. So I was getting short-circuited after a while. And I was just like getting mad at everybody. I told you to do this. Why, how come you did it like this? You know. I was just getting completely frustrated. Because, you know, the frustration was increasing in intensity and frequency. So I'd be getting upset more often and more upset when I got upset. So it built up to a certain point. And the devotees, they were nice devotees. It wasn't. Ultimately, it wasn't their fault. It was just this cultural gap, what I expected, and you know, the limited capacity they had. So at a certain point, I told myself, I said, "There's, you know, do you just want to like be agitated all the time?" And then myself, and I had a conversation with myself. I don't know if you ever had a conversation with yourself. I had a conversation with myself. So I said, "Do you want to be angry and agitated all the time?" And then I said to myself, "No, I don't." Then why are you always, and the other side said, "Well, why are you always getting angry?" And the other side said, "Because they're doing all these things." And the other side said, "Is it worth getting angry?" And the other side said, "No, it's not. I really, really don't want to be angry because it's just disturbing me and it's disturbing them." And you could understand how the conversation went. So after I had this conversation with myself, I made a decision. I decided, I don't feel like getting angry anymore. I don't want to get angry. It's just, that was like the end of the conversation. And guess what happened? Could anybody guess what happened after I made that decision? Brenda Lee, you could probably answer this question. What do you think happened after I made that decision? I made the decision. I am sick and tired of getting angry. Very shortly after that, something amazing happened. Yeah, I stopped getting angry. I realized that it's not what I want to be doing. It's not how I want to be acting, either for their devotees' benefit or my own benefit. And the desire to not get angry so easily, so often, was so strong that I developed this very strong desire to just be normal and peaceful and controlled and calm and tolerant and understanding and forgiving. It just like all came at once. And it was just amazing how much I changed. And I want to tell you another story I had, and I think I told you this story as well. It's a similar experience which changed me, and then I want to make my point of how I changed, because it's important. So we have the one story with this, with all the events that led up to me desiring. The whole key here is I want, the key here to this discussion is I wanted to change. The desire was there to change. And at that point, when the desire hit a certain threshold, I changed. Okay, there was another story. I was living in Vrindavan. I had the great fortune to live in Vrindavan for 2 years. And Vrindavan is a different place, a much different place than anywhere in the world. India is already different, and Vrindavan is diametrically opposed to materialistic environment, big cities in the West, even the small cities. It's so much different. So one of the things that I was desiring on some level for a few years before I went to Vrindavan was to understand humility better. Of course, I think where we get tripped up sometimes is we want to understand something better. It doesn't mean we want to practice it. Like you may give a class and say, in this class, we're going to learn about something. But if you give the same class and say, we're going to practice something some people won't want to come. They just want to learn about it. They don't want to do it. You know, you can sit in classes and you can learn all kinds of things. And you know, that's very interesting. They not do anything. A lot of people do that. We're like, sometimes we're afraid to do anything. It's just easy to intellectualize it. So I was a little bit on that level, intellectualizing humility. But on some level, there was some desire to do it, but it was in a seedling form. And so I was in Vrindavan, and there was a sannyasi, Gaudiya Vaishnav sannyasi, who was visiting the temple. He was an elderly sannyasi, probably in his late 60s, early 70s. And by his demeanor, I could see that he had no, really had no false ego about him. He had no, what do we say? He had no ego, or what's the colloquial expression? He was not all of himself. It was like, it was kind of like when a person, thank you, Jagadish, it's kind of like, you know the kind of people, when they appear, they just kind of don't want to make a scene. They kind of don't want to draw people's attention to them. So, you know, he was a sannyasi. He's walking in the temple, and I could just see he didn't want to draw any attention to him. And I could see this person has understood humility on a much deeper level than I have, and he's practicing humility on a much deeper level than I have. And it struck me very deeply. It hit some chord in my heart. And just by seeing his humility, it was so attractive to me that at that point, after seeing it, I developed a desire to want to be humble. I can't say I developed a strong desire, and I can't say I developed a desire to be deeply humble, but I developed a stronger desire than I had. And maybe I didn't even have a desire to be humble. Maybe I only have the desire to learn about humility but not be it. In any case, his association took me from the point of being interested in humility to the point of desiring it, to seeing it as something I want, to seeing it as this is how I like to live. I actually wanted it. And then at that point I realized that all along my interest in humility had never come to the point where I really wanted it. And it was only at that point when I wanted it would I change. I didn't maybe change a lot, but I changed enough to see the value in humility and to not have such a strong need to bring attention to myself. But I started relishing the idea of not bringing attention to myself, and how nice that was, to just be in the background, to be a nobody. Because this is how he was. He was happy being a nobody. Although I don't think he was a nobody, but that was his position. He was very grounded. So my realization, the reason I'm telling you this story and the other story I told you about my desire to give up being angry, is because I realized that in our practice of devotional service, in any quality we want to develop or any way we want to advance, there's always this crucial point in which the desire to do it strengthens to the point that we change. And if the desire to do it doesn't become strong enough, then we never really change. It's just like we look at it and say, well, that would be nice, or it'd be nice not to be critical of devotees. So in the same sense, I'm making this point because I'm saying if you want to stop criticizing devotees, there has to be a point in which the desire to stop criticizing, and particularly the desire to honor, respect, serve, and so forth, other devotees, develops to a sufficient degree, at least sufficient enough to inhibit that tendency to be critical. And then by capitalizing on that desire, by continually practicing it, you begin to develop the habit, the nature, the disposition to gravitate towards the positive side instead of gravitating towards the negative side. And so until we develop that desire, it's like we don't do things that we don't want to. So Krishna consciousness is the process of following certain principles, developing, or it's like forcing ourselves to develop certain attitudes which may be alien to our conditioned nature, but by continually practicing them, they become more attractive. So that's what happened to me in Vrindavan. The humility started becoming very attractive to me. I remember, you want to hear a funny story? I became a devotee when I was 19. So I moved into the temple in January. In March, I was given first initiation. Didn't even ask for it. That was just the way things were done. And then in August, I got Brahminical initiation. So here it is. It's August 1970. The Hare Krishna movement is not that big then. I don't know. What were there, like 10 temples in 1970? You know, 300 or 400 devotees, 200 devotees? Well, there weren't a lot. So I remember I just got my Gayatri in Los Angeles, and I was living in San Francisco. I went back to San Francisco, and I remember one day I was sitting down chanting my Gayatri, and I was like proud as a peacock. I was like, look at Mahatma. He's a Brahmin. And while I was chanting Gayatri, I was meditating on how people are going to see Mahatma's chanting Gayatri. He's a cool dude. He's a Brahmin. He must be advanced. And I was thinking all these things people are thinking about me. So that's the world I came from, and I entered Krishna consciousness from that world. So to go from that world to come to this point in Vrindavan some 30-odd years later, or it was like 30, it was probably like 37 years later, 36 years later, where I actually felt in the core of my heart a desire to be humbled. That was like a major turning point in my life. And so anytime there's going to be a change, you're actually going to physically feel that desire. You know when you really want something, you feel it in your body. Your body changes. You ever had that experience? You just really want something. It could be the wrong thing. It could be the right thing. You feel it deep within the core of your being. I really want this. I really want this. Or like, I really want to go to India. I really just want. And you can feel it in your entire body. And when you get to that point that you really, really want it, usually it's at that point that somehow you end up there or whatever it is you want. That's just my personal realization, that if everything stays theoretical and therefore we don't practice the principles, or we don't associate with people that have the desires that we would like to develop, and then we cultivate those desires, then it's unlikely that there'll be a change deep in the core of our heart. And then because we really don't desire it, then the changes we want won't take place, or they'll take place very, very slowly and slightly, and we'll still be battling with the other side. So that kind of, I was telling this because it underscores the point I was saying, that some of you are more determined than others, but in either case, unless you come to a platform where you want it, then you won't do it. And so I think part of what we're getting at in these classes is to help you develop that desire by seeing all the benefits of honoring devotees and seeing all the detriments, and seeing how detrimental it is to find fault, and how disappointing it is to our own soul, and how toxic it is, and ultimately how miserable it is to be in a position where we enjoy life by putting people down. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. So, Brenda Lee says, I want to change from the inside out. Yeah, if we don't change from the inside out, if you don't change from the inside out, you're not going to change. That's where all the change takes place. And one of the, one of these incredible advantages that I had and my godbrothers had, is that we got to see Prabhupada personally. And in seeing Prabhupada, he had so many of the qualities that we wanted. We became inspired to be like him. If you ever look at videos, in the early days of the movement, you will see devotees even dressed like Prabhupada. We wanted to be so much like him. We were so inspired by him. We wanted to have the qualities that he had. We wanted to talk like him. We wanted to walk like him. We wanted to dress like him. We just wanted to be another Prabhupada. Of course, we couldn't. We're all individuals. We have our nature. But in his presence, the desire was so strong because of his association, because his qualities were, you know, were wearing on us. So that's also the importance of, if you want something, associate with people who have it. So now, Bhakti and Carol has just said, don't read this. That's great advertising. Because by saying, don't read this, everyone's going to read it. Of course, she said, I think she's saying it to me, don't read it, because it's not on this topic. She said she wants to be initiated, but she was told it wouldn't happen. So, I guess we can relate it to this topic. So, what to do? Develop the desire and the qualification. Three years to remove an anartha. No, I never said that. I think you can remove it in a moment, and it may take lifetimes. It depends on the anartha, and it depends on you. So let's take Bhakti and Carol's example and relate it to what we're saying. If you want to take initiation from a guru, and someone told her, well, it would never happen. Well, Prabhupada said, first deserve, then desire. So deserve to be a qualified disciple, so by being one, and then desire, and when Krishna sees the desire, then he sends the guru. I think in my example, we'll go back to my example of humility, because I was in a sense obsessed with understanding humility, and I really felt humility was key to spiritual advancement, and I felt it was key, it was a fundamental attribute that all of us as devotees required in order for us to work cooperatively to spread Krishna consciousness. So I was seeing it both in my individual case, how important it was for me, and I was seeing how important it was for the movement in general. And so I was, I don't want to say obsessed, but I was really involved in a meditation on this on a deep level. And so perhaps because of that, Krishna sent me this person who personified humility, and it changed my heart. So, you know, when that desire is churning more strongly, more strongly, more strongly, when it hits a certain point, Krishna may say, okay. Brenda Lee is saying, Kremlin saying, he saw the Dalai Lama. So you could feel Dalai Lama's compassion. Yes. Anyone, you know, you feel people's vibrations just by being with them. Bhakti and Carol's, Brenda Lee says, is it better to try to change several anarthas at a time or go at them one at a time? Well, depends what they are. They may be related. I would say we want to try to go to the root, find what the root of the problem is. Like sometimes we may have a problem, but we're not really addressing the root. And sometimes the root can involve a solution to many problems at one time. So I think it's always wise to go, like we were talking last week, when we were asking the devotees, why do we criticize? And so we're coming up with so many reasons, because we wanted to understand it as in both a broad way and a deep way. Because the more we understand why we do something, the more we get to the bottom of why we're doing it, then we can confront on the deepest level the anartha and who we are to carry that anartha and perhaps have a better strategy in dealing with it to know exactly, you know, what the enemy is. Like if you don't understand how poisonous something is, if you don't understand the effects of it and how it's affecting you, you may not be able to resolve it. So it requires a lot of introspection, requires a lot of being open to look at, well, I'm acting this way, what's causing it? And a lot of times, what's causing it is not what appears to be causing it, but it's something much deeper. And then we have to We have to be more open and more willing to look at what's causing it. You know, why am I acting this way? You could say, well, I'm conditioned. Yeah, but let's go deeper. What is it? What are you thinking? What mentality? What beliefs may exist? Perhaps it's a lack of faith. Perhaps it's an attachment to being a certain way or having a certain self-image. I mean, so many things. Perhaps it's a way of thinking that just part of your personality, that you've always thought in a certain way, but it's creating a problem for you. So I would suggest getting right to the heart as deeply as you can be, as you can possibly go, and you might need help of another devotee to be more objective. So, yeah, one step at a time. Yeah, and little steps also. But, you know, you can... I recommend step under the anartha. Here's the... Imagine the anartha. It's a stone, and a stone is like in your heart. You know, and you're trying to get to it. If you can get under it, right? Get your shovel under it and pick it up. That's the best place to go. Otherwise, you might get part of the anartha and not the whole thing. Or Srimad Bhagavatam says that our material attachments are deeply rooted. So if they're deeply rooted, you have to dig very deeply. And of course, part of the process of digging is just the process of Krishna consciousness, hearing and chanting. So you don't want to just work on the anartha and give up your sadhana. You also want to strengthen your sadhana. But at the same time, focus. This is where I need to work and be aware of it. And it's important. If you're not aware of it, you won't focus on it. So, frustration leads to anger. How to avoid frustration? Well, that's a very good question. So now we've been talking about something that I am recommending I would like you all to do, which is develop a different attitude. Give up criticism, at least give it up verbally, and then work on it mentally. And then develop verbally saying nice things about others, and in your mind honoring them. And so, okay. So I try that, and I fail. So Brenda Lee is saying, okay, frustration. So then if I fail, then I become frustrated. I tried, it didn't work. Then that leads to anger. Just become angry. You know, and then when you're angry, what's the next thing? Well, why even bother? It doesn't work. I can't do it. I'm not qualified. Very good question. If we look at it, we try to be objective about it, that from the point of frustration is a natural emotion that would happen as a result of failing at something, or it seems to be natural. But it's a very, if we want to exceed in something, then frustration and anger disempowers us. So in the process of attempting something, rather than be getting frustrated, I would say, okay, I tried, I failed, but number one, never give up hope. Very important. There always has to be hope. And what's that hope? That hope is in Krishna's mercy. By his mercy, I can do it. I failed, but I have hope. If I continue the process, if I continue praying, if I continue making the effort, at some point I will be successful. If we accept in the beginning that sometimes it's going to be difficult, if not all the time, and sometimes we may fail in our attempts, if accept that at the onset, number one, there'll be less frustration. And number two, when we do slip, we can accept it in stride and say, well, I'm a conditioned soul, striving to be a pure devotee. Slipping is to be expected. And we can kind of and say, okay, but if I slip, I must learn from that slip. So what have I learned through this failure? And if I can learn something, then I'm better equipped tomorrow. I failed, but I learned something. So now I'm better equipped to begin this practice again. So there's one stumbling block that I probably won't step on again. I've learned my lesson. So if we could take failure in a positive sense, you know, you're not a failure until you give up. You know, if you fail and then you give up, all right, and then you're a failure. And it's also important to note that when you fail, it doesn't mean you're a failure. It just means you failed, but you personally are not a failure. You're only a failure if you fall down and you stay down, then you're a failure. So I know a lot of us become frustrated because the ideals of Krishna consciousness, the goals of Krishna consciousness, are very high. They're not easy to achieve. And so often we fail in our attempts. And so it's easy to become discouraged. We can even feel guilty and then become even more discouraged. So if there's some assumption or expectation that failure may have to be necessary in order to make progress, or it may have to be necessary for a conditioned soul, that's okay. Srila Prabhupada says that as long as we are not resentful of the goal and the process, then, and he also says, and we show Krishna we're sincere and determined, then it's okay. So then you fall, you slip. All right, I'm a conditioned soul. I've fallen, I've slipped. But my intention is to be Krishna conscious. And Krishna sees that intention. So you're always keeping your intention. And your intention coupled with prayer. Otherwise, frustration and anger will make it even more and more difficult. So you could say transcendental frustration, which breeds enthusiasm. To go on, to learn from that. I don't think there's any other way around it other than just giving up, because the frustration and anger would cause you to give up. So, okay. In Russia, we grew up accepting the fact that everyone was corrupt. Yeah. So then you deal with it accordingly. You're not let down. Yeah, very polluting, yes. But you know, in bhakti, so Carol's making the point, bhakti and Carol's making the point, we expect the results, that equals frustration when the results don't come. I'm expecting something to happen, I don't get it, I'm frustrated, okay. And then she says, do everything for Krishna. Okay, so the essence of bhakti is our desire to please Krishna, our intention to please Krishna. That's the essence. The essence of bhakti is not just producing something externally. That's there. We have service to do, and we should not be neglectful or negligent of that service. But the essence of that service is that Krishna should be pleased, Guru should be pleased. And Guru and Krishna are pleased by what? Not only the service, but the attitude in which the service is done. So then it goes back to the point, if the attitude is, I want to follow the principles of bhakti, I want to raise myself to a certain level, I want to develop certain qualities, that's my intention, and my willingness to stay on the path despite my falling and failing and again get up and continue, and I show Krishna this is what I want, that's what will please Krishna. Now, there's another important point, and I was meditating on it this week, and it is a very interesting point. Because I had read something, or I had heard something, and Vishwanath Chakravarti was saying that as you advance in Krishna consciousness, you still confront your conditioned side, but it becomes more like a distant voice. Like, have you ever felt your mind yelling at you, do this, do this, do it now, you want this, go for it. Nothing can stop you. Just get it. And it's the very thing that will hurt yourself. It will hurt your Krishna consciousness, and it's something you shouldn't do. So your mind is screaming at you, do this, do this. Or look at this. Wow, isn't that wonderful? Don't you like that? Don't you want that? And so he said, as you advance in Krishna consciousness, it becomes more like a distant voice. Like, and you just hear something kind of quietly. Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? But in either case, I was thinking, what's really a powerful meditation or attitude for us is just to look at that. Okay, I decided I want to go this direction. So while I'm going this direction, my mind's going, don't go there. I decided to do bhakti. The mind says, I haven't decided to do bhakti. So there's this conflict, right? You make a decision, you're going to become a devotee. The mind says, I haven't decided to become a devotee. That's your decision, it's not mine. So then the mind's going on, why are you doing this? Do that. Look at this, eat that, taste this, smell this. And so for us, in the process of bhakti, if we can somehow detach ourselves in a way that we separate our intention, this is what I want, from what the mind or our conditioned side is feeling and telling us, it makes it much easier. Because then when we see the mind acting in a way which could be frustrating or discouraging or the tendency for that, we can separate that and say, I am here on this side with this intention to be Krishna conscious, which is what you're expecting and expressing. And also Brenda Lee is saying, I have yet to be able to follow the four regular principles perfectly so far, but I try hard. The fact that you try hard means that this is what you want. That's where your heart is. That's where your intention is. You're just not able to perfectly do it. So the mind is on the other side saying, you don't really want to do that. You can't do that. And look at this. Look at that. You really want that. You always love that. Why don't you go do that? And so if you can become a little detached, or we can become a little detached, and connect more with what we as a spiritual being, what's what we want, what's deep in our heart, and connect with that and say, this is what I exist for. I exist for spiritual advancement. I exist for bhakti. I exist for service. That's who I am. That's my identity. This other thing that the mind's saying, it's not my identity. Now, here's where it becomes crucial. So everyone, pay attention, please. You cannot act in a way which is contradictory to your identity. Whoever you think you are is how you act, and I'll say that again because it's so important. You cannot act in a way which is contradictory to your self-identity, or to say it another way, we all act according to our identity. Now, if our identity is fixed, that I am a servant of the servant of the servant of the servant, then we will act in that way. So that's the identity we connect with in our sober moments when our intelligence is clear. And then the mind comes in and says, no, actually you're meant to enjoy. Look at that. Isn't that beautiful? Why don't you look at that? Look at it more. Why don't you go after that? Why don't you pursue that? That's what you really want. And then the mind gets absorbed. And then the mind keeps dictating through the senses. Look at that. Go there. Isn't that what you want? So, how are you going to deal with that? Well, if you go back to your identity, no, I exist for Krishna's pleasure. I'm Krishna's servant. I exist for the pleasure of Guru and Krishna and for the seva, the service of other devotees. If that's the identity, if that's what you identify with, then all that mind is doing is just, it's kind of like looking at the mind. You're looking at your mind doing all these things, and you're saying, that's really interesting that I'm giving myself to Krishna, but my mind isn't. Isn't that interesting? And so the mind says something, and you look at it. And it's like you can talk to your mind, and you go, your mind's going, look at that person. They're a jerk. Look what they do. They're so stupid. They're so dumb. Blah, blah, blah. And so on and so forth. And you can just stand back and look at it and go, isn't that interesting that my mind speaks this way? Particularly, I just heard this class by Mahatma, and I'm really getting centered on being more of a forgiving person, more of a compassionate person, more of a person who understands others and doesn't want to put them down. And now my mind is criticizing this person. And you can just look at it and go, isn't that interesting? You know, so by saying, isn't that interesting, you're creating space between who you are and who your mind is, because you're saying, isn't that interesting, because I have no desire to do that. Right? My only desire is to be a devotee. And the mind's got this whole other world of things going on. Now, what did Prabhupada teach us? Yeah, Brenda Lee said, yeah, it takes extremely conscious effort to keep on the mark. Wonderful point, and I'll talk I'll talk about that in a minute. What did Prabhupada teach us? Well, the more you give into the mind, the more strength it gets. The less you give into it, what happens? There's two things to starve if you want them to leave. Who knows what they are? Two things to starve if you want them to leave. Does anybody know what they are? Uddhava, you know? Two things to starve if you want them to leave. One is a fever. If you get a fever, don't eat. Of course, sometimes you get so sick you can't eat. The second thing to starve is a guest. Someone's staying in your home and you don't want them to stay, don't feed them, and they'll leave. So just starve a fever and starve a guest. So also, if the mind is acting up, starve it, don't feed it. So the mind is saying, do this, do that. And you're saying, that's interesting that you said that. I can't really believe why you would say that, because I'm going to the temple now and you're telling me to go somewhere else. You're telling me to go to the bar and have a drink on my way to, and I'm on my way to the temple. That's really interesting, but I'm not interested. You know, it's funny you say that. I still haven't figured out why you would say that. I'm on my way to the temple. Or I go to the temple and I'm not in a devotional mood and I'm distracted and my mind's distracting me. And it says, that's interesting. I'm at the temple. I've come here to be in a devotional mood and you're not in a devotional mood. And so gradually you want to try to neglect the mind, you know, give it less energy, starve it, so to speak. Now, Brenda Lee has made another very insightful and important point, and she said this. Whoa, it's already 9:06. Time flies when you're having fun. I have to make this point because it's so important, and I think this will be the icing on the cake of everything I said. It will all make sense. I'm not saying it doesn't make sense, it'll make more sense. Brenda Lee says, it takes extremely conscious effort to keep on the mark. And isn't that true? If you enter the Krishna conscious realm and you think you're going to make it by sitting on your laurels, you won't. And so really what Brenda Lee is saying is something we all know. Anything that you're going to do that's difficult requires, what did she say? Extremely conscious effort. Yeah, it does. I'm going to be giving a class in 2 weeks in Columbus, Ohio. So, of course, this class is being recorded, so I have to give the date. It's going to be September 18th and 19th in Columbus, Ohio at the temple. I'm sorry. It's 19th and 20th. We've got our calendar here. 19th and 20th. I'm doing a workshop there. That's 2009. Some of you may be hearing this class in the year 2027, for all I know. But 2009, September 19th and 20th, we're doing a class, a full day on forgiveness. And the second day, we're doing a class on sexual purity for men. So this exact theme that you brought up, Brenda Lee, is one of the main themes of this class. It takes extremely conscious effort, or an extreme conscious effort. You have to be extremely conscious. You have to make an extremely conscious effort to keep on the mark. That's the truth. It's like there's no, you can't be lax and be sense controlled. It's because the mind is always going to be there tricking us. The senses are always disturbed. So to follow Krishna consciousness, you have to have this very, you always have to be conscious. You always have to be seeing things from a Krishna conscious perspective. As soon as you don't, the mind just is always looking. The mind and senses are always looking for opportunities. And I don't know if any of you have experienced this, I'm sure you have, that you may have been doing well for quite a period of time, you know, a few days, few weeks, few months, few years in Krishna consciousness. And then all of a sudden, either you allow yourself to deviate a little bit, or your mind just gets a little disturbed, or your senses, and you put your guard down, and all of a sudden, you know, you just go zoom, choom, bang, and you bottom out. And you were thinking, that would never happen because I was doing so well. And then, boom, you crash. So that underscores your point, Brenda Lee. We have to be extremely, have to make an extremely conscious effort all the time. It's like we're walking on a tightrope. You can't just go, well, let's just cruise and not pay attention. You know, that's my experience. Dr. Greg, I'm like, well, sign up. Yeah, that's right. You're in Columbus. Yeah, now we get to meet. Somehow I thought you were in New Vrindavan. Yeah, so that's going to be 19th and 20th. Prem Vilas is organizing it, and if you don't have his email, just write me, and I'll give it to you. Bhaktin Carroll's, I understood we had to control, I guess it's called, over the choices we make, but the ultimate outcome of events as such is not up to us. Yeah, just write me and I'll give you the contact information. Can we hear this class live? Well, I'm going to record it, but I'm not sure what I'm going to do with it yet, because a lot of it's going to be confidential. But I'll record it, and then you know, people are going to be sharing, and they may not want to share their dark secrets to the whole world, but we'll record it. Or Manjesh, you can organize a course in your area and we'll come out there and do it. Or we'll do it online. That's also possible. We can develop it online and everyone can take it. But I want to go to Bhaktin Carroll's question. I understand we had control over the choices we make, but the ultimate outcome of events and such is not up to us. We do have control, but we don't have supreme control. I think it's disempowering to think we don't have control, or we can't do anything about the control we don't have. Like sometimes it appears we're out of control, but to think we don't have any control when we're out of control, to control what we're out of control, is that's it. Then we're finished. So sometimes it seems like we're just overcome. I think what you're saying is, like, it seems like we're overcome by desire sometimes, like out of the blue. It just hits us. And then we think, well, I'm not really in control because all of a sudden this desire is there. That's true. But we have control how we now respond at that point. And that's where the discouragement comes, because we're doing well in Krishna consciousness. All of a sudden we get hit. And then we can become discouraged because we get hit. And so, well, I'm doing everything and it's not working. Or it was working for a while and it's not working now. So we become discouraged. So everybody has that experience. It's very easy to become discouraged. But it's at that point, it's at that very point, we need to become more enthusiastic, not discouraged, and think, I can deal with this now. I can do something about it, rather than say, I can't do anything because the desire is so strong and it came out of nowhere. No, that's how we lose the game. So what you say is true. We don't have choices, but we do have choices. You know, I don't always choose what my mind's thinking. I don't always choose what I'm feeling. It just happens. But I can choose responses to it. Like I'll give you an example in the class, in the forgiveness seminar I do. I think I told you this before. I create a hypothetical situation and I say, what if your best friend ran off with your wife and they took all the money in the house and the kids and you were like out on the street basically? How would you feel? Everybody says, I'd feel angry, I'd feel upset, I'd feel terrible, I'd feel depressed. I feel like strangling my friend, beating him up. I feel like crying, you know, just all these emotions, right? So that's natural to feel that way. But the point is, okay, you feel that way, but now what are you going to do? How are you going to deal with that? How are you going to process all this? So then you begin to start to process it. Okay, these feelings came upon me. So I start to process it, and I start to look at what did I do that caused my wife to do this? How am I going to go on in my life now? She doesn't want to talk with me. How am I going to be sane? So you start to react to it and make choices of how you're going to react and deal with it so you don't go crazy. So that's the point I'm making. Does that make sense? Okay. Yes, it's getting late for me. I haven't even eaten dinner yet. It's not good to eat late at night, but okay. So thank you all for attending. And we're going to continue. We'll have a few more classes on offenses. I want to like really churn it. I really want to churn it to see if we can make a, you know, I can hit you. or I don't know if high can hit you, but if somehow or other we can take it to a level where you actually want to, because if you don't want to, then it's almost like all this is in vain. You'll just be the same. But if we can develop a desire, then something's going to happen. That's the point. Thank you, Jagadish. You're welcome. Thank you, Kremlin. Bhakti Greg, hope to see you in 2 weeks. That'll be wonderful. Maybe I'll sing my song for you live. Hare Krishna. Okay, we'll see you all next week. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Hare Krishna.